And welcome to another Hank Unplugged podcast. This is a podcast that is devoted to bringing the most inspirational, informative, interesting people on the planet directly to you. And I'd like to take a moment at the beginning of this podcast to speak directly to listeners of Hank Unplugged. If you are not already subscribed to the Hank Unplugged podcast, well, subscribe right away. Why? Because this will ensure that you will never miss a single podcast. But there's another reason. It is that every single review matters. My stated goal for this podcast is to bring the most interesting, informative, inspirational, and I will repeat that over and over again because that is precisely what I determined to do and precisely what I have done. The most interesting, informative, inspirational individuals on the planet to as many people as possible. So here's your action step, your step to make a difference. Leave a review and a 5-star rating on iTunes or, for that matter, wherever you consume your favorite podcasts. That will expand our audience. And, of course, our reason for that is to equip a greater number of people, an ever-growing number of people, to become reproducing disciple-makers for the kingdom of Christ. And, of course, many of you are giving us reviews, and I have been absolutely humbled by the reviews. And I don't take the reviews personally. It's because of my guests that we get these 5-star ratings. One homeschooler listening in Canada recently wrote, "This podcast is so very meaningful. Hank is quite gifted as a host and interviewer, but the length, the breadth, and the height of these discussions on the podcast go to exhilarating heights. Join the support team people, pitch in, and help keep programming like this coming." And of course, the support team is very, very important because we not only do a broadcast, we now do a podcast. We have a whole arsenal of digital media platforms. And we invite people to stand with us shoulder to shoulder in the battle for life and truth. You can support the broadcast, the podcast, and the many 24/7 outreaches of the Christian Research Institute in a safe, secure fashion on the web at equip.org or by simply writing me at Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. And with that, I want to introduce the guest for this podcast. He is, in my humble opinion, a rock star. His name is Stephen Meyer. He received his PhD at Cambridge. He's a former geophysicist, college professor, and he now directs Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. He has written some of the most extraordinary books, books that I believe ought to be in the library of every single person listening to my voice right now. And you can find those books on the web at equip.org. I think about the New York Times bestseller, Darwin's Doubt, or Signature in the Cell, which, by the way, was named Book of the Year by the prestigious London Times Literary Supplement. But Dr. Meyer has contributed to the Christian Research Journal, and for that we are eternally grateful. Some of the articles, Unlocking the DNA Enigma, Darwin's Doubt and the Case for Intelligent Design. Dr. Meyer is also co-editor of a massive volume, which I have very much enjoyed. It's titled Theistic Evolution, a Scientific, Philosophical, and Theological Critique. And I say about that book that under the banner of theistic evolution, a growing number of Christians maintain that God used evolution as his method for creation, and that I believe to be the worst of all possibilities. It's one thing to believe in evolution. It's quite another to blame God for it. Indeed, theistic evolution in my view, is a contradiction in terms. It's sort of like flinging around the term flaming snowflakes. God can no more direct an undirected process than he can create a square circle. And yet this is precisely what theistic evolution presupposes. Modern Christians too often buy high and sell low. Just as neo-Darwinian evolution is fighting for its very life, it's being propped up by an irrational hypothesis embraced by many, many Christians. I want to talk about that and so much more with my guest today on Hank Unplugged, Stephen Meyer. So great to have you on the broadcast.
Hey, it's terrific to be back with you, Hank. Thank you for having me.
I always love having you. You know, you are, as I said at the beginning, you're a rock star in my eyes. I have benefited so greatly from your life in ministry. And I suppose one of the great things that you're doing is you're leading the ID movement in many, many ways. You are now directing Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. And at the very outset, I think we ought to talk about ID, because a lot of people think this is a science stopper. You would say, I suppose, that this is following the evidence wherever it leads.
Well, yes, and also it's a science generator. We're sponsoring a lot of exciting new research projects. If you think life is the product of a designing intelligence, there are certain expectations you would have about how life is put together that are different than if you think it's the result of an undirected, unguided process. And so there's been kind of two phases in the development of our research program. One has been to explain some of the key facts that have been left unexplained by neo-Darwinism and other undirected materialistic models of evolution. For example, the digital code that's stored in the DNA molecule, or the functionally integrated, irreducibly complex nanomachinery and circuitry that we find in cells. Those are facts long known that had been not adequately explained by materialistic evolutionary theories. But having explained those key facts of life better, many of us now think it's time to start generating hypotheses about other things that ought to be present in life. And we have a number of really good researchers now at universities and research institutes around the world who are taking the ID concept, running with it, and developing testable hypotheses. And we're getting some fantastic results from some of those experiments and some of those investigations. So ID is both an explanatory research program, but also what is known in the history and philosophy of science as a program that has heuristic value. It leads to new discoveries. And this week, in fact, we have our summer seminar running with young scientists, mostly PhDs and students and postdocs from around the country and around the world. And many of them are very excited about the more productive research that can be done from an ID perspective.
So what would you say the state of the ID movement is today? Are you optimistic? Are you pessimistic? Are you exhilarated? What's your feeling towards this?
I think the state of the movement is actually it's very robust. It's gone international in a way that's unexpected. It's going mainstream in a way that people are, I think, mainly unaware of, which is in some ways a consequence of the need for some of the key researchers to keep their heads down to be able to develop these concepts in a mainstream environment, because there's so much ideological pressure and so many cases of the really grotesque abridgment of academic freedom. One of the researchers that we have here today that illustrates both that and also the growth and dynamism of the ID movement is a German paleontologist named Günter Beckley. He's a contributor to the book that you've mentioned on the critique of theistic evolution. Günter did his PhD at the University of Tübingen in Germany. He was a curator at the Museum of Natural History in Stuttgart, which is the largest natural history museum in Germany. He reached out to us in 2009 in the anniversary year of the 200-year anniversary of Darwin's birth and the 150th anniversary of the Origin of Species. There was a big display at the museum. He was the curator for that display on Darwinian evolution. as a result of the display he created, one of his colleagues suggested that he read the books by the intelligent design people because he was surely going to get asked about them. His display had set up a strange it was a scale of justice, and on one side he had The Origin of Species, and on the other he had a number of the books written by the leading intelligent design people, and he made the scale such that Darwin's one book outweighed all the others. So he had a catchphrase, the book that outweighs them all. And one of his colleagues said, well, you know, if you're going to make that claim, you better read their books because you could get asked about this. And so he did and ended up reaching out to us because he said he was now in a difficult position because he read the books. He realized that the critique of intelligent design was inaccurate, unfair. We'd been misrepresented. We had made a lot of really good points, and he was becoming deeply skeptical about Darwinism. That was 2009. In 2016, he came out publicly for intelligent design and then encountered a number of problems at the museum. They couldn't fire him, but they told him they didn't want him there anymore, and they ended up reaching a negotiated settlement. Recently, Wikipedia erased his Wikipedia entry. He's had numerous species named for him. He's one of the leading insect paleontologists in the world and was a very big figure in paleontology, still is by our lights, but Wikipedia no longer deems him as a person. And so he's experienced quite a lot of opposition, pushback, abuse from coming out publicly for intelligent design, but he's also inspired an awful lot of other people because he's a really big fish in science, and some of his longtime colleagues have been communicating with him privately, explaining that they're beginning to have big doubts as well about Darwinism. So that kind of thing is happening. We can't tell all those stories, but Professor Beckley, or former Professor Beckley, Dr. Beckley, is just one example of a really high-powered scientist who's been reading the books on intelligent design, has become persuaded, and is now taking those ideas and running with them in his own research.
You sort of alluded to this, but I think it may bear some underscoring. I think it has been said, and quite accurately, that other than the Bible, Darwin's magnum opus, The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, it might well be the most significant literary work in the annals of recorded history. In fact, that's what Sir Julian Huxley once said. He called it an evolutionary dogma that spawned the most powerful, most comprehensive idea that has ever arisen on the earth. I mean, a bit of hyperbole here, but I mean, it's significant, the most fundamental of all intellectual revolutions. And that revolution took hold because if, in fact, you can explain the world without God, you're no longer accountable.
Well, it's not that surprising in a way when you think about this in worldview terms, because every worldview has to, it being the impact of the origin of species and of the theory of evolution, every worldview has to answer a very fundamental question, perhaps the most fundamental, which is what is the thing or the entity or the process from which everything else came? And the Judeo-Christian worldview has long answered that by reference to a personal God who has conscious agency, who makes choices, who's intelligent, who has many attributes that theologians will talk about. Well, that's been one answer to that question, and it was the answer through most of the last 2,000 years in the West. And when Darwin came along, he answered that question in starkly different and materialistic terms. And his theory, complemented with other theories about the origin of the solar system, the origin of the very first life, which Darwin didn't attempt to explain, and ideas in a kind of sort of secular cosmology about the universe being eternal and self-existent, kind of by the end of the 19th century, presented a very different view of the origin of everything important. Whereas in the theistic view, matter and energy were a product of a pre-existing mind and the power of that mind to bring it into existence. In the materialistic worldview, matter and energy were eternal and self-existent and had the power to self-organize and self-arrange. And Darwin's theory was a big part of that naturalistic or materialistic story. So you had a series of these theories of origin at the end of the 19th century that gave rise to what scholars call scientific materialism, which is a philosophy built atop of scientific ideas. And what's happening now is that scientific materialism, which was supported by Darwin's theory, is now being challenged at its foundation by the discovery that matter and energy are not the whole show at all, that there's a third fundamental aspect of reality. That reality is information, or that aspect, that feature of reality is information, and information in our experience comes from minds. And so what we're discovering with the evidence of design in biology and physics and cosmology is powerful evidence for that theistic view which was discarded at the end of the 19th century. I call that the return of the God hypothesis.
You are, and I want to talk about this a little bit, you are directing Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, and I want you to talk about that organization. You're affecting cultural change, but you also have your finger on the pulse of academic freedom.
Well, right. One of the things that we do is defend scientists and their freedom to look at the scientific evidence from a different point of view. In biology, a lot of that has to do with just the ability to express doubts about standard evolutionary models without having your tenure threatened or your grant money withdrawn or your PhD examination cooked so you don't get the PhD. And we can't defend everyone. It's a very difficult situation culturally within the scientific world. There's a sociology of science, but we've had some good successes in defending some key people. And one of the things we do with our summer research fellows, the young scientists that come to get an intensive orientation on all these issues, we also talk with them about the perils and the challenges of having a theistic or an ID-friendly or even just a Darwin skeptical point of view and negotiating the culture and the sociology of science and surviving in that culture to ascend to a position of influence down the line. And we've had some good success stories with that. So I think it's quite surprising in the last few years, even to us, how many senior professors there are around the world who are friendly to ID and willing to do research from that point of view. And so we're trying to spawn that revolution and protect people as they join it.
When you think about this issue and this intellectual freedom, I wrote a book called Muslim, What You Need to Know About the World's Fastest Growing Religion. And in that book, I quote a person who is talking about stakeholder interests and incentives. And he's making the point in his book that this affects the research of academics in the humanities no less and perhaps even more than those in the sciences. But he delineates this as motivated blindness, which inhibits an individual's ability to perceive inconvenient data. He talks about shoddy research that's carried on by university professors, then it's repeated by journalists. And then, of course, the whole cultural agenda, the selling of a particular cultural agenda. And I would add to that, I think we're living in an age in which there's a serious case or an epidemic of Christophobia. This affects the academic institutions in a way that most people simply cannot perceive, which is to say that they hear things said by scientists and they say a scientist says it and therefore it has to be true. And they don't realize that scientists don't go into the lab with a white lab coat on. They have their preconceived notions. And so talk about that, because I think people need to get a grasp that this authority complex needs to be broken down. We need to critically think, and we can think on every level. You don't have to have a PhD. You can think.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a really good point you're making, Hank. There's a tremendous amount of groupthink in all human institutions, and science is not in any way immune from that. And the groupthink tends to be centered or focused around issues where there is a significant ideological debate in play or a significant worldview issue in play. So there's a whole lot of science that's relatively ideologically neutral. If you want to find out how one protein binds to another protein, or if you're working on the mechanics of a biosynthetic pathway, pretty much everyone from different worldviews will agree about the research there and what it ends up showing. If you want to ask, well, how did that biosynthetic pathway arise in the first place? How did life arise in the first place? Are human beings a product of nature, nurture, or something else? Is human behavior perhaps influenced by free will and deliberations about morality and things that go beyond nature and nurture? So if you're in the social sciences, you may encounter that kind of an ideological issue. In those cases, the preconceived or the assumed worldview of the investigator will have a tremendous effect in constraining the range of hypotheses they're willing to consider. So one of the things that we've been challenging in the ID movement is not just the scientific arguments for chemical or biological evolution or theories thereof, but we've been challenging a principle of method known as methodological naturalism or methodological materialism that says if you're going to be a good scientist, you must limit yourself to strictly materialistic explanations for everything. Well, we think that that's a reality-limiting assumption, or it limits our ability to possibly know reality as it is. If you're in the social sciences, it may well be that there is something like a mind or a soul that gives people powers of agency and choice that are not determined by underlying laws of physics and chemistry, and therefore nature and nurture is not the only way to look at a human being. There may be a third option, a third hypothesis that explains behavior that is not materialistic. In the same way, if we're looking at the origin of life and we find that at the foundation of life there's digital code, it may not be the most rational or most scientific explanation. It may not be the best explanation to say it developed by undirected material processes of chemical reactions or chemical interactions. We know from experience that code and information comes from a mind. If we walked into the British Museum and looked at the Rosetta Stone, we wouldn't want to say that wind and erosion did that. We would want to say that a mind played a role in the creation of that information. So what we're doing is we're challenging the way in which some of these secular and materialistic assumptions, worldview assumptions, are limiting the intellectual freedom of scientists to follow the evidence where it most naturally leads. And so I think that speaks to your point. I would also say these young scientists that we're working with know full well that there are huge ideological pressures within scientific laboratories, scientific classrooms, scientific departments. And there's, by and large, the default worldview of many scientists is a kind of secular materialism or atheism. And young scientists who have a different worldview are very aware that they've got to play their cards close to the vest because those ideological pressures are very real and they affect the perspective and the theories that come out of the scientific community.
No question about it. In fact, you've been called a pseudoscientist. I mean, you're obviously a brilliant writer.
Well, the thing is, on Wikipedia, they used to say I was a theologian, which was their way of stigmatizing me. And we tried to edit that because, friends of the ID movement told me that they would get in and try to edit those entries because I have no degrees in theology, physics, earth science, philosophy of science, but none in theology. So eventually Wikipedia did change that, I think, and now the latest is that I'm a proponent of the pseudoscientific theory of intelligent design. It's interesting, though, that one of the co-founders of Wikipedia has actually said publicly that Wikipedia's portrayal of intelligent design is deeply and unconscionably prejudicial. And he's been critical, even though he's not a proponent of ID, he said as an encyclopedia, they ought to do much better in the objectivity department.
And you're dealing with this with a great deal of humor. I mean, I think that's what you have to do.
Well, I've been telling our friend Gunter Beckley, the German paleontologist, in fact, I like to introduce him now, is the guy who got erased from Wikipedia. That's because he's that dangerous. You know, this is a badge of honor. Far more people know about him now that he's been erased because there was quite a controversy about whether Wikipedia should have done this. And it just spotlighted the fact that we have a leading European paleontologist who has become a proponent of intelligent design. And he did so initially from a non-religious viewpoint. He was initially a scientific materialist himself. He had a conversion scientifically, first to Darwin skepticism, secondly to intelligent design, and he has very recently also become a Christian, a Catholic. And so this is, he's not supposed to exist, and so we're actually grateful to Wikipedia for drawing attention to the kind of people who now think intelligent design makes sense.
Talk a little bit about what Benjamin Franklin said. He said, if we don't hang together, we're going to hang separately. You mentioned that he became a Catholic. There are many people in the Christian world that would say he became a Catholic. That means he still is not a Christian. And I think there's this unnecessary division between Christians. We ought to be divided when it comes to those things that militate against the essentials of the Christian faith, but unite it around the essentials of the Christian faith. We say in essentials, unity, non-essentials, liberty, all things, charity. But there's so much fragmentation within the body of Christ. And in an age of scientism, I think it is incumbent upon us to stand together and not be, well, so territorial and tribalistic. I mean, it's okay to have your own tribe, but let's not be tribalistic.
Yeah, beautifully said, Hank. As you know, not all proponents of intelligent design are Christians, but many of the leading members of our movement are. In our seminar that's going on this week, we have a secular Jewish scholar who is a staunch proponent of intelligent design because he thinks you can detect the activity of intelligent agency scientifically. He's in the field of computer science and mathematics. So I need to make that disclaimer, but I am a Christian. I'm a Bible-believing Christian, and so are many of my Catholic colleagues. I'm an evangelical, but I had a Catholic upbringing, so I'm kind of a Catholic-friendly evangelical, and there are more and more evangelical-friendly Catholics. In fact, Dr. Beckley's conversion to Christianity, which postdated his scientific conversion to intelligent design, was aided and abetted by a lot of leading evangelical apologists. He loved the work of Bill Craig. I could tell you more of his story, but so he's a very evangelical Catholic, and there are many such people. And in our seminar this week, there's a priest from the Vatican who, and we were talking about these differences, and he just got a twinkle in his eye, and he said, the most important thing is that we're all Christians. And one of the wonderful things, so the byproducts of this advancing secular materialistic juggernaut in culture, is that it has awakened Christians to what they have in common and caused them to realize that we need to have each other's backs. And yes, we can have differences of opinion about these doctrinal issues that separated people in centuries past, but it's long past time to get over that and unite around the essentials. And there's a tremendous unity around those essentials that has developed, and people are more aware of that. I work at an institute where we have, in addition to very serious Catholic scholars and scientists, evangelicals, people who are Greek Orthodox, we have Orthodox Jews in our institute who have a common worldview and understand that there's a deep commonality between the Christian and the Jewish worldview, and I'm very thankful for my Jewish colleagues. So I think that spirit, I think there's actually something very pleasing to God about that. I'd just say that as a Christian layperson, not as a trained theologian, sorry Wikipedia, but I think there's something really wonderful happening, and that's the flip side of the sort of gathering persecution that you find especially in the academy against people of faith.
I want to talk a little bit about your New York Times bestseller, Darwin's Doubt. Darwin's Doubt, I think, revolves around the Cambrian explosion or the Cambrian radiation. I mean, this was something that absolutely upset his awful cart.
Well, right. I mean, Darwin was, for all of his rhetorical excesses, and there were some, especially that as we see more and more about the way the science works in retrospect, but he was, I think he was rhetorically modest in most of his work. And that is to say, he was willing to acknowledge things that were puzzles and things that his theory didn't explain. And one of the big classes of evidence that he recognized did not fit with his theory was the discontinuities in the fossil record, which didn't fit with his branching tree gradual picture of the development of life over time. And one of the biggest discontinuities was the event that we now call the Cambrian explosion. Darwin was very much aware of it. He wrote about it. And he said it was inexplicable at the time. He didn't have, it would have to await further discovery. He thought that the fossil record would eventually get filled in and maybe solve the problem, but it hasn't. The problem of discontinuity has grown more pronounced. And so it was a big problem in his day, but it's become a more, and this was the argument I made in the book, in a sense I told the story of the mystery of the Cambrian explosion and showed how the mysteries become more acute for two reasons. One, because the missing ancestral fossils of these Cambrian animals that appear very abruptly in the fossil record, those missing ancestral fossils have not been found. But secondly, the abrupt appearance of all this biological form in the fossil record, and it's not just a Cambrian phenomenon. It occurs up and down the rock column where you get brand new forms of life emerging abruptly. It raises essentially an engineering question. How would the evolutionary process build all those new forms of life? And that problem's become more acute as well because of what we've learned about the importance of information to life. The information stored in DNA and other places in living cells is absolutely necessary for building animal form. So when we see new forms of life arising in the Cambrian explosion and other times in the history of life, we're not just witnessing explosions of biological form, we're witnessing explosions of information. And the Darwinian mechanism doesn't explain that very well at all, and yet we also know that information invariably in our experience comes from a mind or an intelligence. So I think we're looking at a very powerful evidence for intelligent design as we look at these abrupt appearances throughout the history of life.
I think it's fair to say that the Cambrian explosion is biology's version of the Big Bang. So just as cosmology's Big Bang undid the dogma of an eternal universe, you have biology's Big Bang uprooting Darwin's tree of life.
Absolutely. And in fact, many paleontologists have referred to the Cambrian explosion as biology's Big Bang. And there was even a cover story on Time magazine in the late 90s after the discovery of the Chinese Cambrian find near the Chinese city of Changjiang. And it was called Evolution's Big Bang. But one of the paleontologists who was quoted in the article said, "How much faster does this event have to get before we stop calling this evolution?" So it's very abrupt, geologically and biologically speaking.
What does a young Earth creationist do with this? I mean, I know that you're a colleague of Paul Nelson. I've had him on the broadcast many times. I think he's one of the most phenomenal Christian men I've ever met. He is articulate. He's well-read. He's well-studied. He has a gentle spirit about him. He's always willing to reach people rather than to win arguments. I just can't say enough good things about him. But
it's absolutely true. He's one of my closest friends and colleagues, and he is all of that. You're absolutely right.
But there's so many in the young Earth creationist camp that make young Earth creationism an acid test for orthodoxy. But my question goes beyond that. What do they do with the Cambrian radiation?
Well, first of all, Paul does not make it an acid test, and
that's one of the reasons we work so well
collaboratively. And so we have many young Earth people in the ID movement, but the young Earth people who do make it an acid test tend not to be comfortable working collaboratively with people who hold an old Earth view as I do. Paul and I spent some time trying to argue about one summer. We tried to discuss the age question, and we got kind of bored. It didn't seem like the most important thing. But, you know, Paul is actually quite he's very willing to say, you know, I don't think the science actually fits. I hold to a young Earth for other theological reasons of, you know, the way he interprets the Genesis account, and he's sort of willing to live with that tension or ambiguity. There are young Earth attempts to sort of compress the time scale and preserve the discontinuity, and so the discontinuity sort of speaks to some kind of infusion of information and therefore design. A lot of the young Earth scientists that I know are kind of fideistic in their approach, in that they kind of work within an old Earth framework for the sake of argument in their scientific work, but then as Christians they say, but I've got to take what the Bible says about this seriously, and so they kind of wear two hats, or have, it's kind of a noma strategy, a non-overlapping magisteria. I personally don't work very well with that kind of fragmentation. I think it's better to integrate all the evidence we have. And I've never myself thought the Bible taught a young Earth. The day four part of the creation account seems to me to be pretty decisive. We're told that the sun and the moon are given as markers of the days, the years, and the seasons. So we have 3 days of creation established before we have time markers, before we have a way of denominating time in the way we do today. So I think the Bible's giving us a very clear textual clue or cue that the days of creation are not denominated temporally the way we denominate time. And so I think we have to be very careful not to impute our ideas of time on those days. And so they might be short periods, but they might be long periods. I've felt it was important to look to the science to settle the age question. And to me, the evidence is pretty decisive. So that's kind of where I come down on this. But I'm also not, in the same spirit that Paul adopts, not willing to make this an issue of doctrinal it's not a sine qua non of being an Orthodox Christian, because the ID issue is, it's not really an issue of age, it's an issue of design or no design, design or merely apparent design, as the Darwinists say. We have people in our movement of both persuasions, and we haven't made that an issue between them.
Well, I'm so glad. And I'm glad you're working collegially with Paul Nelson. I know you are, and I think that's a great example for the rest of the body of Christ. And as Christians, I think it's important that we do science well, but I think it's also important that we learn the art and science of biblical interpretation, that we learn to read the Bible in the sense in which it is intended. And so, yeah, these are important things, but great to hear that the two of you had a discussion, you got bored, and you recognized that you had bigger fish to fry.
Well, that's exactly right. And we both have a calling to do that in our own understanding of our life's mission. And so to get distracted by it just has become a very toxic issue in the Christian world. We were at Wheaton College in April, and we had theistic evolutionist professors in the audience. We had young earth students, and we got asked about the age question afterwards. We each gave our take, and then we explained that we had tried to argue about it once, and we lost interest, and we got a big laugh from the audience. I think it lowered the temperature in the room. I think people are tense around it unnecessarily. And Philip Johnson, one of our intellectual founders of the ID movement, said, yeah, he said, sure, it's an important issue, but it should never have become a causus belli in the church, a cause for war. And biblical interpretation is always important, he said. But and so I think that's been the spirit with which we've approached this.
Signature in the Cell, your book, is the first book to make a comprehensive case for the ID principle based on DNA. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, it was a book a long time in coming for me, embarrassingly long with respect to my colleagues. I had a teaching position with a heavy teaching load when I first got out of grad school. In a few years after that, John West, my colleague at Discovery, and I founded the Center for Science and Culture. Eventually, that caused me to leave the teaching, but then I had administrative responsibilities. But all the while, I was working on this argument that I had begun to think about in grad school. It's the argument from DNA, the extraordinary discovery of the 20th century, and maybe in the history of science, is the discovery that at the foundation of life is digital information stored in the double helix molecule DNA. And I had been thinking about the implications of that for a very long time. One of the really exciting parts of that whole molecular biological revolution, post-Watson and Crick, they make the discovery of the structure of DNA in 1953. In 1958, which happens to be the year I was born, Crick put forward something called the sequence hypothesis, where he realized that the DNA was storing information in the digital or alphabetic form, that the chemical subunits of the DNA are functioning like alphabetic characters in a written language or digital characters in a machine code. And within a very few years, that was confirmed. And then as people began to think about that, they realized this is a big problem for both biological and chemical evolutionary theory, because if you think about random mutations, for example, you start changing a section of highly specific code where the arrangement of the characters is necessary to the function that it performs, whether it's in a computer domain or in an English text or in the DNA context, you change specifically arranged informational characters, you're going to degrade that information long before you're ever going to come to something fundamentally new and informational. No computer programmer wants random changes introduced into some functional code. It's going to destroy the code as the changes accumulate. So I just began to think about, well, if the undirected materialistic processes can't explain the origin of information, what does? And a lot of my work in my PhD in Cambridge was on the methods of reasoning in the historical sciences. And Darwin himself had a key criterion of a good historical explanation, and that was that it posited a cause which is known to produce the effects in question. He called that the vera causa principle. As I began to think about that, I realized there was only one cause of which we knew that explained this key effect in question, that key effect being information, and the cause being intelligence. One of the leading information theorists said early on, the creation of new information is habitually associated with conscious activity. Well, if that's something we know, then what can we infer about the information present in the DNA molecule? It must have also arisen from conscious, rational activity, from intelligent design. And I developed that argument in the book first in Signature in the Cell, as I looked at the question of the origin, the ultimate origin of biological information with the first life.
I also want to talk a little bit about your massive volume. It's a book that you were the co-editor of, titled Theistic Evolution, A Scientific, Philosophical, and Theological Critique. For a lot of people, the term theistic evolution is quite fluid, and there are a lot of reasons for that. First of all, the word evolution has a lot of fluidity associated with it. There are a lot of different meanings you can pour into that word. So talk about that moniker, theistic evolution.
Yeah, absolutely. The first thing we did in the book, I actually wrote the philosophical and scientific introduction. Theologian Wayne Grudem did the theological introduction, but I wrote the scientific and philosophical one. The first thing I did was exactly what you indicate is necessary, which is to define some terms. And there are several different meanings of evolution. Some are innocuous and uncontentious, like change over time. Then there's a second meaning, the idea of universal common descent, the Darwinian idea that all of life has morphed and changed from a single common ancestor, creating a kind of branching tree pattern throughout the history of life. And then the third meaning is the idea that an undirected, unguided process, namely natural selection acting on random mutations and variations, has produced all the forms of life implied by that tree of life, that that's the mechanism or the process that has generated new forms of life. We critique not evolution number one in the book, but evolution number two, and especially evolution number three. We laid the greatest stress on that really contentious claim, and one which is, I think, also metaphysically laden. If the process by which everything arose is undirected and unguided, that lends itself readily to a materialistic worldview. If there is guidance, direction, or design, then that lends itself to a theistic view. And so that is a really crucial scientific and philosophical issue, and we focused on that in the book. Going back to a comment you made as you were introducing the interview today, I think one of the things that I really wanted to achieve with this volume is to reduce the intellectual insecurity in the Christian world. There's a great number of theologians and Bible scholars and pastors who have been influenced and pressed by groups like BioLogos, the BioLogos Foundation or Institute, and other Templeton-funded groups like the Center for Theology and Natural Sciences, the Faraday Institute in England, where these groups are pushing some form of evolutionary theory, neo-Darwinism or some other maybe more current form of evolutionary theory on the Christian church on the grounds that this is the way that God created. This is their idea that God created through this evolutionary process, and that since the scientific community is lockstep in favor of this view of biological origins, to go against it is to bring intellectual disrepute on the church. And that's their main argument. They say that Christians need to get with the times and accept that this is what science says. And what is hugely ironic about that is that mainstream neo-Darwinism, still the orthodox and textbook theory of biological evolution, is now being roundly rejected by leading evolutionary biologists themselves because they realize that this mutation natural selection mechanism has very little creative power. And they are saying things like, the mechanism explains the survival but not the arrival of the fittest, the small variations with things like Galapagos finches, but not where new things like birds come from in the first place. And beyond that, other newer post-neo-Darwinian evolutionary models are also not panning out very well. They're not explaining, for example, the origin of biological information, the genetic information you need to build new things. So in the book, we wanted to show to Christian lay people and Christian leaders that they don't need to make this strange intellectual amalgam or even compromise by trying to fuse essentially a materialistic theory of origins with a Christian doctrine of theology. The science doesn't support the materialistic theory of origins, so let's not feel under that kind of obligation. And we wanted to free the Christian leaders and theological leaders from the sense of intellectual obligation to somehow synthesize some form of Darwinism with Christian ideas about the doctrine of creation.
So many people have heard of Francis Collins, The Language of God, has become very, very popular. It's widely recognized as having been able to bridge the chasm between the biblical worldview and the evolutionary dogma, but it's problematic, and you're alluding to this. It's problematic not only from a biblical perspective, but it's problematic from a scientific perspective. A huge body of scientific evidence challenges the creative power of the mutation selection mechanism, and again, I call that, you know, buying high and selling low.
Yeah, it's very good. One of my colleagues, Jay Richards, another evangelical Catholic, by the way, he talks about theologians making virtue of necessity. And very often what you have is a theologian will say, well, you know, this is actually, there's a good theological reason for getting rid of the idea of the soul, or a good theological reason for adopting Darwinism. And then they come up with some tortured a kind of rationalization. But he said what they're doing is making virtue, theological virtue, of the cultural necessity or sociological necessity of accepting Darwinism as a condition of acceptance in the culture. And we're trying to say no longer necessary. It wasn't a good strategy before. It's worse now because even leading mainstream evolutionary biologists are saying we need a new theory. Many of my colleagues and I attended the Royal Society meeting in November of 2016. We write a bit about it in the Theistic Evolution book and pointed out that the meeting was called by leading evolutionary theorists who wanted to evaluate the current status of neo-Darwinism in a critical and skeptical way, because most of them who called the meeting were critical and skeptical, and secondly, to explore what other evolutionary mechanisms might be in play that could either replace or supplement the inadequate mechanism of mutation and selection. At the beginning of the conference, the first talk was by a prominent Austrian evolutionary biologist, Gerd Müller, who outlined the explanatory deficits of the neo-Darwinian mechanism and neo-Darwinian theory. His talk could have been taken right out of Darwin's Doubt. He talked about the problem of phenotypic, that is, body-level visible complexity in organisms. He talked about the problem of anatomical novelty. Where do you get all these new complex structures? And he talked about the abrupt appearance of fossil forms in the geological record. None of these problems, he thought, had been solved. The problem of the origin of biological form, he lists with a co-author in another book, is an unsolved problem. At the end of the conference, as they explored these different other possible evolutionary mechanisms, one of the people who was a prime mover in a group called the Altenburg 16, which are evolutionary biologists critical of neo-Darwinism, and who was involved in putting together the conference, said that unfortunately the conference was characterized by a lack of momentousness. This is Susan Mazur. And so, in other words, the conference defined the problems with neo-Darwinism effectively at the beginning, but at the end, even the proponents had to realize that they hadn't solved those problems. So this is a very strange time for the big push in the Christian world to get Christians and Christian leaders to effectively baptize neo-Darwinism or some other form of evolutionary thinking when there's such a crisis in the field. Science does not impel us towards that compromise. We're not under an obligation to synthesize these two systems of thought. People need to stick to their theological guns.
And there's a reason why, too. I mean, I think we have to pan back and look at the fact that ideas have consequences. You think about the absolute chaos in the culture today as a result of the sexual revolution. The concept of a creator God is said to interfere with our sexual mores. Well, we've rationalized God out of existence, and now we have, I mean, things that honestly I never ever expected to see in my lifetime, where now gender is not determined by biology, it's determined by your feelings.
Well, let me talk about another cultural consequence of this. It's, I think, very poignant and very, very of great personal concern to me. We have an epidemic of suicide among young people in this country. And just in our local sphere of personal associations, we have known a number of young people who have made that just really tragic choice, or known families where that have been afflicted by that. And very oftentimes, when you get to the bottom of what's going on, yes, the psychologist will call it depression, or maybe it's anxiety and depression, or it's something, but there's often a metaphysical element to it. I myself went through this as a 14, 15, 16-year-old, where I had the very deep questions. I didn't know they were philosophical questions. I didn't know they were metaphysical questions, but they bothered me, and I couldn't answer them, and that made me think something was wrong with me. And I later, after my own conversion, I began to read the Bible on my own in my late teen years, and I found that many of the questions that I was asking about the meaning of life, what's anything going to matter in 100 years, what is time, is there anything that's unchanging, how do we know things? I had these questions I couldn't answer. They bothered me, and it put me into a kind of a downward spiral, and it was the Bible that pulled me out of it. And it, I didn't have one of those conversion experiences where suddenly I felt great joy, but I felt normal for the first time because I had structure to my thinking. I had a framework for answering questions that previously I couldn't answer. And we had a call from a bereaved father soon after the release of the film Expelled. and his son, a young man named Jesse Kilgore, had committed suicide. And his story was very, very compelling. And the father said, if he had only seen your film, I know he would have known there were answers to his questions. And Jesse had been in the military. He was a military chaplain. He got out, went back to school, was in a university taking biology. He had an aggressive new atheist professor who was proselytizing the students in service of the new atheist creed. He challenged Jesse to read one of the big new atheist books. Jesse did. It really shook him. He was, from the margin notes they found in the book after his death, he was taking this very seriously. He couldn't answer the questions. First he lost his faith, and then he lost his hope. And whereas these professors will talk about how human beings are pollution or how life has no meaning and revel in that, young people are looking for answers to those deep questions. And when they're told that science undermines the possibility of answers, or that it gives them an essentially nihilistic answer, that there is no meaning, that all we have is mindless particles in motion, and when we die, we rot, and that's all there is, it raises that great existential question, which is, why continue to live? And so I think this epidemic of teen suicide, or the suicide of young people even into the early 20s, is something that has a metaphysical root. It's a consequence of that that depressing scientific materialistic worldview, which very easily transitions from scientific materialism to another worldview called nihilism. And so it's just one of many cultural implications of this way of thinking. It's not an argument that scientific materialism is wrong. I think you have to prosecute that argument on the basis of the evidence. But these ideas do have consequences. And if they are wrong, by all means, we need to oppose them. I love the passage from 2 Corinthians that says, we come against every argument and pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God. And I personally, as a Christian involved in this work, am concerned to help restore the knowledge of God in the culture.
It's interesting that you bring that up. I'm just reading a book by Paul Chamberlain, Why People Stop Believing. And one of the things he points out at the introduction of that book is how many people who are academics have left the Christian faith. And oftentimes when you read them for all the wrong reasons, for example, you have Bart Ehrman, who's made a cottage industry out of writing books that he is very proud to say have caused all of the Christians that come through his classes, and he's pretty universal on that, to leave the Christian faith. But when you read his arguments or his objections, they seem rather easy to deal with. But
They're phenomenally weak.
But there are so many people like this, and there's a sense in which if someone writes a book against Islam as a former Muslim, that person has a tremendous amount of credibility and weight. And it seems to me that the same thing is true when someone has been in the inside of Christianity, as it were, as an academic, and now they're writing works to debunk the Christian faith. That seems to have tremendous weight for so many people who are looking, obviously, in many cases, for an excuse to rid themselves of any objective reference to truth.
Sure. That works the other way, too, though. We have a lot of scientists who've been on the inside with Darwinian materialism who are moving the other direction. So I think that is a hopeful thing for the future. And there are also a lot of good archaeologists who will defend the historicity of the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament. So I don't think people should let Bart Ehrman be the last word on those issues either. I did a series on the scientific evidence for intelligent design, and extending that further to look at the case for God, but also on the archaeological evidences for the reliability of the Bible. It's called True You. Young archaeologists who work closely with me on the research on that, Bart Ehrman gets up his nose because he, as you were saying, thinks the arguments are very weak and they're not apprised of all the wonderful archaeological corroboration there is for the Bible from Abraham all the way through Jesus. So that's another topic we could discuss, but it underscores, I think, a bigger issue, which is the need for an intellectual defense of the Christian faith in a time when so many academics just reflexively want to say it has no credibility. To me, it's very odd because in many ways there is more evidence now than there has ever been, and it's very compelling.
Yeah, well said. I want to get back to this whole idea of concepts having consequences. You want to address the racist implications of the evolutionary model? We're living in a state of cognitive dissonance, it seems to me. You have cultural elites who are rightly lauding equality, the equality of men and women. They're rightly censuring the notion that there are superior and inferior races, and yet the evolutionary dogma, by its very nature, seems to me to necessitate inequality.
Well, certainly in the 19th century, there were many of the leading evolutionary biologists who thought that the gradation of forms extended through the different racial groups of humans, and that there were higher and lower races corresponding to more or less evolved or more or less advanced in the evolutionary, I hate to use the word progression because evolution isn't supposed to say anything about progression, but somehow that idea was incorporated into this. So there was a lot of scientific racism that came out of the 19th century. It spawned the eugenics movement. My colleague, John West, has written very extensively and persuasively on this, and he has an award-winning new film out about the role of Darwinism and scientific racism around the turn of the 19th to 20th century, in a very sad case of a young African man, Odabenga, who was actually displayed in a New York zoo in the first decades, I think it was the 1906, 08, in that time frame. So there is an untold story of the racism that Darwinian evolution spawned. A lot of evolutionary biologists today would, of course, want to reject that and say that it's not inherent to the theory. It's something you could debate, but the history of this is, I think, indubitable.
And you have this whole idea of, in the modern world, the elimination of unfit genes. So Iceland, for example, you have Down syndrome baby abortions, you have the pre-implantation of genetic diagnosis technology, and with that, the idea is if we can eliminate the unfit genes, then the fit genes can multiply more rapidly.
It's a form of positive eugenics. I think you're right. And you also, negative eugenics is you exterminate people with genetic defects. Obviously, the Nazis were big into that, but there was a fair amount of that going on in the United States, not through extermination, but through sterilization. And those practices only stopped after the death camps were revealed by General Patton. So we have a very unsavory history of that in the United States up to the end of World War II. And some of that is coming back with this sex selection abortions, various things that have an echo of that. I think the whole issue of abortion versus the sanctity of life is something else that reflects that underlying worldview issue of, and materialism, I think, leads naturally to the presumption that a fetus in the womb is just a collection of tissue or a lump of cells. Abortion is justified very often on a very materialistic sort of rationale. And so it's another one of the consequences of Darwinism, this creation story. Materialism is the worldview built atop that. But those Darwinian materialistic assumptions do play out into a number of ways. And the thinking that dominates our culture, and that's why our center is called the Center for Science and Culture, and we mean to renew both with better ideas.
What's really interesting in the abortion debate today is that the argument is shifting. Now there's little gravitas in saying that this is not a human being. There's too much evidence that the developing embryo is a human being. So now the argument shifts to whether or not that being is a person that has worth or weight or deserves to live.
Yeah, I suppose that's right. The ultrasound technology that has exposed actually the cognitive abilities of the fetus very early on, the response of fetal pain to the abortion procedure, I think, has moved a lot of people to recognize, no, we're dealing with a human in development that is aware. As I recall, the neurological evidence shows that the fetus is not responding just reflexively to pain stimuli, but actually in an aversive way that shows coordinated motor movements and things. So that, I think, has moved a lot of people away from support for abortion, that technology. And it's but anyway, we're maybe getting a lot off topic for me, but I did write about that a bit in the 90s, and I think the scientific evidence of personhood is pretty strong.
Well, let's get back on topic. I want to get you to react to some of my favorite quotes, not favorite in a positive way, but Richard Dawkins, for example, said, "Biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose.
Right. I actually really appreciate Dawkins because of the clarity with which he defines essential issues. He's always on the wrong side by my lights, and he would say the same of me, I'm sure. But that's the key issue in biology. Is biology the result of merely apparent design? Does it manifest the illusion of design? Or does that appearance of design indicate the actual activity of a designing intelligence in the origin and history of life? Dawkins says it's merely apparent. That is the Darwinian answer, going back to Darwin himself. And that's why our theory was named the theory of intelligent design. We were wanting to contrast our view with the view of the Darwinians who say that design is only apparent. And it's also one of the reasons we haven't gotten big into fighting about the age of the Earth, because we think that that is really the key issue, design or no design, design or merely the illusion of design. So we appreciate Dawkins for framing that issue so clearly.
And Ernst Mayr, he said the real core of Darwinism is the theory of natural selection. This theory is so important for the Darwinian because it permits the explanation of adaptation, the design of the natural theologian by natural means instead of by divine intervention.
Right. It's the same issue. Is the adaptation was the appearance of design that most struck 19th century biologists. Birds live in the air. They have wings. They make nests. Fish live underwater. They have gills and swim bladders. And so every organism seemed to be fitted to the environment in which it lived. And Darwin came along and explained at least the way in which organisms can adapt in a minor way to their environment. And therefore, he thought he'd explained adaptation as the result of the unguided, undirected process of natural selection. I like to use the example of woolly sheep in the far north of Scotland, and how if you breed just for woolly sheep, if you just choose the wooliest generation after generation, you're going to get a woollier breed in that cold climate. Darwin came along and said, in effect, well, what if you have a series of very cold winters, such that only the wooliest survive to breed? Won't you get the same outcome? And that idea works very well for the small-scale variations and adaptation on a small scale. What biologists are finding today, however, is it doesn't explain the origin of things like sheep or mammals or animal forms in the first place. So it explains the adaptive survival, but not the arrival of the fittest. And so the appearance of design that struck the 19th century biologists, at least things like sheep getting woolier and finches getting slightly bigger or smaller beaks, Darwinism explains well. It does not explain those major origin events. It doesn't explain the information, perhaps the most striking appearance of design in biology, that's necessary to build new animal forms. So, again, Mayr frames the issue beautifully, but I think what we've learned since the Darwin Centennial in 1859, when he was a big player, or since Darwin himself, or even since Dawkins wrote the book Blind Watchmaker in 86, has strongly pushed the case for real design, not just apparent design.
To that point, Francis Crick said that biologists have to constantly keep in mind that what they're seeing was not designed, but rather evolved.
Yeah, it's the same concept that life looks designed, but it's not really designed because an unguided, undirected process produced the appearance without itself being designed or guided in any way. And we have taken the opposite view. Things look designed because they really were designed. Living organisms have specific appearances of design, like digital code or like functionally integrated circuitry or nanotechnology, that does actually bear all the hallmarks of a design system and which has not been explained by the undirected, unguided designer substitute mechanism of natural selection. So again, beautiful setting up of the binary choice on the central issue. And that Crick quote is especially, I think, instructive, because with his quote, you see that the appearance of design is very strong, that you have to remind yourself, you've got to talk yourself out of the evidence of design. And I think we need to get back to the phenomena and say, well, maybe they're telling us something, and take them more seriously, especially since we know that the designer substitute mechanism has really not done a good job of explaining the complexity of life, which is the most striking appearance of design.
Here's one more. This is by UC Berkeley professor of psychology, Allison Gupnik, and she says this: by elementary school age, children start to invoke an ultimate godlike designer to explain the complexity of the world around them, even children brought up as atheists. And thus she advocates for the pedagogical goal to teach young children evolution before the wrong view is too firmly in place.
It's a form of materialistic re-education. They used to do that in the Soviet Union with respect to the Marxist form of materialism. It also speaks, I think, to what the philosopher Alvin Plantinga calls the innate noetic capabilities of human beings, and that our minds, when they're properly functioning, do perceive that design, and we're meant to do so.
The myth of Darwin's Tree of Life, for the average person listening in, I think this is something that ought to be underscored over and over again. It's been uprooted, and yet you find it being explicated and pictured. It's an icon that seems to never die.
Right. Increasingly, both aspects of Darwinian evolution are being questioned. Creative power of the mechanism, of the mutation selection mechanism, has been questioned for quite a long time now. One of the leading scientists at the Royal Society meeting said that criticism of neo-Darwinism has become so early 90s, it's passé. But increasingly, the other part of Darwinian theory, the pattern, the historical pattern, not the process, the theory of universal common descent is being questioned. Our colleague Paul Nelson is playing a big role in that. One of the huge discoveries of contemporary genomics is the discovery of what are called orphan genes. These are genes with no known sequence similarity or homology to other genes. Now, on a Darwinian view, every gene should have evolved from some other gene by a very small incremental accumulation of mutational change. And so you should see a high degree of sequence similarity between every gene and some other gene somewhere in the biological world across the phylogenetic categories. And in fact, a growing number of these orphan genes are being found in across the taxonomic categories. It's a very big new area of study in biology. They shouldn't exist on a Darwinian model. They speak to the discontinuity of groups, not to the continuous morphing of one group into another as depicted by the Tree of Life. So just one of many evidences, I think, against common descent. Another was beautifully explicated yesterday in our summer seminar by Gunter Beckley, who was talking about not just the Cambrian explosion, but 17 or 18 other major fossil discontinuities, other major fossil radiations. The first sea reptiles, the first fishes, the first birds. You just go right through the fossil record and the different types of organisms. They appear very abruptly. So in both the genomic and the paleontological record or data, we have discontinuity, not continuity, both of which are speaking against the Darwinian Tree of Life view of the history of life.
You think about Darwinian views. Darwin speculated that bears might well evolve into whales. And then I would say in stark contrast, you have contemporary Darwinists, neo-Darwinists, who hold that hippo-like animals evolved into whales. I mean, it doesn't seem like you've progressed a whole lot.
Well, right, and the evidence there is, I think, very weak. There's a superficial kind of reconstruction of fossils that you can align if you want to, but the characters that define the distinctive features of aquatic mammals occur very abruptly in that sequence in a 1 to 3 million year window. And there's a further problem with the whale sequence, which is called the waiting times problem. My colleague Richard Sternberg will be presenting on that tomorrow to I'm sorry to keep referencing our context this week, but we got all these bright young scientists here. And the Darwinian mechanism, there's a Darwinian math. It's called population genetics, and it allows you to calculate the amount of evolutionary change you would expect to occur in a given amount of time if you know certain factors like the size of the population and the generation times and the mutation rate. And Sternberg has calculated that to get just two coordinated mutations in this transition from land-dwelling mammals, hippo-like ancestors, to the basilosaurs and the other aquatic first whales, you would need something like 43 million years for just two coordinated mutations, and yet you have hundreds of anatomical innovations that take place between the two types of organisms. It's not easy to put a land-dwelling mammal and get it to live and reproduce underwater. And Sternberg goes through all the details, and the transition is actually really implausible from a Darwinian point of view.
What does science today say about the plausibility of a historical Adam and Eve?
We have a research project on that. It's not specifically around the biblical concept of Adam and Eve, but could human beings have originated from a two-parent breeding pair? And there is actually a section in the theistic evolution book on this current research that's being done about this genomically. And until recently, there was a study by Francisco Ayala that people took as sort of gospel. A lot of theologians were told that science had settled the issue, that there was humans at best might have emerged from a group of 10,000 hominids or something. Actually, very recently been established by a research team that we've been supporting and conceded by members of the BioLogos Foundation, who are theistic evolutionists, that the genomics is perfectly consistent with a two-parent origin for anatomically modern humans. That's us. There's debates about how long ago that would have taken place, but the genomics is consistent with that model. And there'll be a lot more coming out on that. That's an active area of research that some of our genomics and genetics people are working on. Ann Gager is the key scientist working on that, a molecular biologist. And much of that research is in the Theistic Evolution book for people who want to read more on it.
And again, that book available, you can find it on the web at equip.org. One major question I want to ask you, and that is whether or not you think it's true. Obviously, this is a bit rhetorical, that there is a 98% similarity between human DNA and chimp DNA.
Oh, my goodness, don't even get me started on this. This is the worst science in the world. Yeah, so many things to say. The first, there is a high degree of sequence similarity of many proteins of humans and chimps. The sequence similarity will probably be settling in the low 90s. Right now, I think the best estimate is about 95%, not 98%. But there are multiple layers of fallacy in this. The first is that DNA is not all of what it takes to build an animal form. DNA builds the proteins, and proteins do not an animal make. And so we have low-level informational modules that are quite similar to the low-level informational modules that are in chimps and other animals. In fact, we have high degree of sequence similarity, a lot of different things. Our sequence similarity is closer to chimps, that's true, than others. But the 95% similarity is not at all impressive to computer programmers, because they also use informational modules, and they reuse them in lots of different ways. And the low-level code gets reused in very different applications. And so the difference that makes a difference is often a very small amount of code. So that's one thing to point out, because the difference that makes a difference is often the higher-level codes that's telling the lower-level modules how to be arranged. And what we now know about the junk DNA is that the non-coding regions of the DNA are functioning. They're not the residuum of a long trial-and-error process of mutation and selection. They are functional, the non-coding regions, and they are functioning to regulate the timing and expression of the coding modules, the parts of the DNA that build for proteins. So we have a lot of things we're learning about how small bits of code can make a big difference, or about how regulatory code can coordinate the use of the parts of the code that get compared, like our hemoglobin molecules that capture oxygen in the bloodstream are highly similar to those of monkeys. I think they may be 100% similar. They do the exact same job, but when such proteins get turned on and turned off is an entirely different matter. So the regulatory DNA is very different between chimps and humans, and that makes a big difference. In addition, we have what's called epigenetic or ontogenetic information that's necessary for body plan construction that is not the same and is not even measured, because we don't have a good way of measuring that yet between chimps and humans. In addition, there's a paper that's just come out, or coming out soon, in our top biology journal, Biocomplexity, by a young computer scientist who's showing that the way in which computer scientists use and reuse modules of code, it's what in the computer science is called the dependency graph, and the dependency graph model does a much better job of explaining both the similarities and the differences in code that we find in chimps and humans than a standard Darwinian tree model. So looking at code from a computer science point of view gives a much better description and explanation of the patterns we see in the code, which is a design-based way of looking at things rather than the, well, simple similarity points to common ancestry argument. Sorry for such a long answer. I told you not to get me going.
I wanted to get you going on that, actually. But here's one other thing I was just thinking about, and that is something that Thomas Nagel said. He's a noted atheist philosopher, of course, he said that defenders of intelligent design deserve our gratitude. His quote goes on to say that even though writers like Michael Behe and Stephen Meyer are motivated at least in part by their religious beliefs, the empirical arguments they offer against the likelihood that the origin of life and its evolutionary history can be fully explained by physics and chemistry are of great interest in themselves. Another skeptic, David Berlinski, has brought out these problems vividly without reference to the design inference, even if one is not drawn to the alternative of an explanation by the actions of a designer. The problems that these iconoclasts pose for the orthodox scientific consensus must be taken seriously. They do not deserve the scorn with which they are commonly met. It is manifestly unfair. How cool is that?
Yeah, well, it was very cool. I mean, Nagel was, he's an eminence in the American Academy and leading philosopher of science, NYU. He's been very clear in his own about his own worldview. He's said, I had a wonderful lunch with him in New York, and he said that he simply doesn't want the universe to be the kind of place in which there is a person such as God. He's temperamentally inclined towards atheism, but he's seen the force of the arguments that we've made. He wrote his own book, Mind and Cosmos, how the neo-Darwinian materialist explanation of reality is almost certainly false, I think was the subtitle. I'm indebted to him because he recommended my book for commendation with the Times Literary Supplement, and then continued to defend his choice in a very heated exchange of letters in that journal after it was published. I thought he'd want nothing more to do with the issue, and then 2 years later he came out with his own book. So he's a very interesting figure. Berlinski is, full disclosure, one of my closest friends. I love the guy. He's just a very, very authentic man and a deep, deep intellect. And he is a fellow of the Center for Science and Culture and the editor of a fascinating new journal called Inference that maybe you're readers would be interested in. It's an international review of science. It's kind of like the New York Times review of books for science, and he's got all kinds of interesting people across the spectrum writing and doing what you indicated needed to be done earlier, which is not take the authority of the scientists at face value, but critically evaluate lots of different ideas in science. And so he's, I think, one of the great intellectuals of our modern culture, and I have tremendous respect for David.
And he's eminently quotable.
Very quotable. Yeah. Oh, what a wordsmith. You know, he's a great writer.
I remember him saying that Darwin's theory of evolution was the last of the great 19th century mystery religions. And he said, as we speak, it is now following Freudianism and Marxism into the nether regions. I'm quite sure that Freud, Marx, and Darwin are commiserating one with another in the dark dungeon where discarded gods gather. That's one that you could not only hear but memorize quite quickly.
Yeah, I know him very well, but I had not heard that quote. It's his business card is a trip because he's a mathematician and a philosopher by training, but he's an extraordinary writer. I think he's published 17 books, and he lists all of the different types of writing that he is willing to be paid to do, including calling down imprecations on one's enemies and funeral perorations. And anyway, he's very funny as well as a deep and authentic person. I love him very much. He's a great friend.
Well, I'm jealous. I don't know him personally, but I think it'd be a blast too. One last thing, we end with this, and we've sort of alluded to this, but the insiders in the evolutionary community, they're fairly aware of their theory's desperate condition, but the general public, I think, is as yet in the dark. And that's where, well, Christians at large come in. You have a PhD. You're obviously brilliant. You're well-spoken. You're well-read. You've written prodigious works. But the average person in the pew, the average Christian, has to get involved. They need to always be ready to give an answer or reason for the hope that lies within them with gentleness and with respect. You think about the apostles. They stayed in Jerusalem. The believers went out into Judea, Samaria, to the ends of the earth. They turned an empire right side up. And that's what has to happen in our epoch of time. Your comment.
Well, we have gotten the same advice from our advisory council. We are winning arguments by any reasonable measure, they say. But the challenge that we face now is that not many people know. And so it puts a great kind of imperative on us to begin to develop other kinds of materials to get the message out. And we're putting a great deal of stress on media and communications as we go forward, in addition to mainstreaming our research program. So we've got two M's right now, media and mainstreaming. And that's kind of where we are in the strategic development of this long-term project. And both of those things, unfortunately, cost a third M, which is more money. But, you know, we have lived to this point on what we call just-in-time financing. So we're hopeful. We've been working with a media company, which has some just terrific connections into Hollywood with some very good writers. There's a lot of stories to be told, and we'll be doing a lot more with media going forward. But that's a big place where we're putting effort, because we have textbooks. We have done a lot of wonderful videos, and you've highlighted them with Illustra Media. And we'll be doing more of that kind of straight science documentary work. But we want to be bringing things into theaters and textbooks, into a lot with YouTube video shorts and various types of media that can take advantage of the internet revolution. So that is the challenge. More people need to know. My colleague John Lennox in Oxford says that the new atheists are reaching millions while we're reaching thousands, and we want to reverse that curve. So that's where we go next.
Absolutely.
And we thank you for always giving us a platform to do that with your wonderful audience, because that has really helped. And we've had people come to us because they've heard your podcasts and broadcasts. So we are attracting a lot of young talent, and I think that is the most encouraging thing of all.
Well, it has been a blast having you on the podcast. I appreciate your work so much. We'll pray for you as you pray for us, and together we'll make a difference while there's yet time.
There we go. Absolutely. Thank you, Hank. And blessings on you, and thank you for the good work you've done for many, many decades now, not generations. Neither of us are that old.
So, I'm getting there.
Yeah, that's hang in there, man.
Well, hey, great talking to you.
You
great
too.
Having you on the podcast. And by the way, for everybody listening in, I want to speak once again directly to you. If you're not already subscribed to the Hank Unplugged podcast, subscribe right away. That'll ensure that you never miss a podcast. And secondly, every review matters. My goal for the Hank Unplugged podcast is to bring the most interesting, informative, inspirational people on the planet to as many people as possible. I think I did that today. And I think we're all grateful to Dr. Stephen Meyer. He's incredible, and his works are incredible. You can find them on the web at equip.org. Again, a quick review, Signature of the Cell, Theistic Evolution, A Scientific, Philosophical, and Theological Critique, and Darwin's Doubt, The Explosive Origin of Animal Life, and The Case for Intelligent Design. These are epic works, again, available to those who support the ministry. Check it out on the web at equip.org. When you leave a 5-star rating on iTunes or wherever you consume your favorite podcast, you make a difference, you expand our audience, and you equip people all around the world to become reproducing disciple makers to extend the kingdom of Jesus Christ, not only for time, but of course, for all eternity. Thanks for tuning in to this edition of Hank Unplugged. Look forward to seeing you next time with more of the podcast.